Listen, folks, thanks so much for letting me come down here this afternoon and speak with you and join in your celebrations. I believe it's your 50-year anniversary, so many congratulations. I was going to ask each of you to take out your mobile phone and to search Google Images, but I've been informed that the internet signal isn't that great here. So instead, what I'd like you to do is imagine anything from the press, from the TV, or from social media, but an image of loyalism. And if any of you feel comfortable, if you wouldn't mind raising your hand and with one word describe what it is that you see.
Masks.
Violence.
Red hand.
Mural.
Petrol bombs.
Bonfire.
Down the back. Parades. Whoa. I am going to stop there, folks, because they say that a picture paints 1,000 words, and I'm conscious that I've only 15 minutes, so we'll not test that theory. I remember at the age of 11, my dad had sat me down to tell me why him and my mother had separated and why he no longer lived with us. He told me that his housemate, Stephen, was in fact his boyfriend. And it was my first year of post-primary, or big school, as Mummy likes to call it, and I remember sneaking off to the library at lunchtime, and I typed the word gay into Google so that I could better understand. But I hadn't anticipated that what catapulted onto my screen would shape my understanding for the next 5 years. I hadn't anticipated that as a result I would hate my dad and that I would hate gay people. I no longer wanted to understand. I had seen enough, I had read enough, and I was left utterly embarrassed and ashamed, and entirely in line with the sentiments of condemnation that have filled my screen. Of course, for any of you that know me, I'm now in a civil partnership and I'm out in proud lesbian. My own experience has taught me the struggles of being society's outcast in 2015, let alone how it must have felt for my dad, a closet gay man in the 80s. But it took time, it took engagement, and it took empathy for me to move from that initial position of fear, hostility, and even hatred to where I am now, as I say, an openly proud gay woman. But what has that got to do with loyalism? It's not about succumbing to our gut reaction or allowing others to tell us what something is. The lesson which we can draw from that is that we need to be willing to look beyond the surface, because to do so will allow us to see the whole story and not just an excerpt. I'm going to talk a wee bit about perceptions and the impact that they can have. And I guess, like the word gay, the perception of loyalism has changed. Once considered key stakeholders in moving this country forward via the peace process, loyalists are now more referenced as flaggers and protesters that are holding Northern Ireland back. But are we holding Northern Ireland back? Or is it that those in government have moved on and consigned the loyalist working class to the past with no place in the future? And for many, the latter is a genuine perception. I remember on May 24th, the polls had closed, and I was standing in the Great Hall of Belfast City Hall, and they'd just declared my election. And of course, everything happened really quickly. I had friends that was tugging me one direction for a picture here or a selfie there. But I was dragged to one side, and that was for my first interview. And here I was, this young female, non-conforming to the political stereotype. And the first question that I was met with was, "Congratulations, Julianne, from flag protester to a councillor. What motivated you to join the Progressive Unionist Party, the political wing of the Ulster Volunteer Force?" It's a legitimate question, but one that set an unpleasant precedent that despite policies that are economically socialist, socially liberal, and entirely left of centre, and more importantly, in stark contrast to the other unionist parties, it was pretty evident then that loyalism was expected to answer for its past, whilst those in government planned for the future. Regarding the past, I'm a little older than the peace baby generation. However, I have no recollection or experience of the Troubles, possibly a result of my mother's meticulous efforts in sheltering both my sister and I from the goings-on outside of our home and of our church. But I do have experience of working with ex-prisoners, ex-combatants and others within the Loyalist constituency, encouraging their involvement in the political process so as to enable them to embrace the principles of participative democracy. I also help them to play an active role in working for social change, both for the enrichment of their own lives as well as the life of their community. But encouraging my constituents to do that is incredibly difficult. because they feel disengaged and politically irrelevant, yet are expected to do the heavy lifting and influence their communities to conform to a society in which they feel they have no stake. A lot of hard work, but very little recognition, and that is most of the post-agreement loyalist experience. Bonfires are a very, very good example on how loyalism feels misrepresented. Bonfires are a legitimate expression of loyalist culture with historical significance. The media and other citizens focus on the small number of bonfires steeped in flags, election posters or banners that bear a message of protest. We at the Progressive Unionist Party don't condone this behaviour. There's no need to burn paraphernalia or anybody else's flag to celebrate our culture. It is, however, an unfortunate condition of discontent and one which needs to be constructively addressed. We want to see change, we want to see progress, but we believe that condemning whole communities is counterproductive when encouraging positive change. And there's many positive examples that I can draw on this year, Woodvale Park being one of them. Big House Unionism is famous for its scaremongering over the union, but our concern isn't for the union. The union's safe and it's copper fastened by the Belfast Agreement, and we believe that it will remain as such for years to come. But what we do condemn is the manipulative tactics deployed by the larger unionist parties, preying on those who feel their place and value in society is already undermined. For many of us, growing up in a working class community, good citizenship has been about knowing your place. We've been encouraged to be followers rather than champions of our own communities. And that practice has led many of us to the margins of society. Our priority is about building a Northern Ireland in which we want to live, one that epitomises the British values of pluralism, inclusivity, mutual respect and tolerance, but one in which citizens have the quality of life in which they enjoy it. We want to contribute and we want to finish what it is that we started when propping up the Good Friday Agreement. And for that, we need others to engage with us. For those of us who are genuinely interested in moving Northern Ireland forward, I believe that we need to commit ourselves to promoting a diverse society rather than reacting to a divided one. In order to build a truly shared future, it is essential that each citizen, regardless of their national identity, political ideology, social class or status, feel engaged, valued and included. Involvement in the political affairs of Northern Ireland must not be limited to those who have traditionally seen themselves as the political leaders of unionism. Working class loyalists have as much right to engage in what David Trimble once described as real politics. Just in closing, I'm sure that some of you may have read or at least heard of the Principles of Loyalism. But for those of you who haven't, it's a document produced by the Progressive Unionist Party which outlines the key components of the Loyalist cause. And I've brought some copies along with me today, and I'd like to implore those of you who are willing to look beyond the surface to do so, explore the whole story and not just an excerpt from a negative image. Thank you.